We don't have a quorum, but we're going to get started just to make sure we have enough time, so. And Minsky was first, so we'll start with them. But first, I want to introduce our new fiscal analyst, Melissa Johnson. And how many pages do we have? Are any of them new? He's on the phone. Okay. The other one's on the phone. Representative Halsman.
And Mr. Chair, is our committee administrator new since our last meeting?
Well, we kind of ignore committee administrators for the most part, but yes, he is new. Would you like to introduce yourself?
No, I
will. I'm Tom Freeman. I'm just joining from the redistricting committee, so you can blame me later.
Gentlemen, proceed. State your name for the record.
Chair House, my name is Stephen Rosenstone. I'm Chancellor of Minnesota State Universities and Colleges, and it's a great pleasure to be with you and be with the committee today. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss with you our investment priorities to help us ensure that we do several important things. One, to ensure that we protect access to an extraordinary education for all Minnesotans. Secondly, that we are in a position to meet the workforce and community needs of our state. And finally, that we're in a position to ensure that we continue to provide the most cost-effective, highest-value higher education alternative in our state in our service to over 400,000 students each year. I'm joined today with Brian Yolitz, Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities. Brian leads both the capital investment strategy and setting priorities for projects that we bring forward, and also he's responsible for the implementation of those projects that are funded. Brian joined us just a little over a year ago, coming to us from the Air Force, where he was a colonel, 27 years of experience in logistics and facilities management. It's a great joy to have him as a member of our team. I am also joined today, Chair Howes, with several presidents from our colleges and universities, representing Metropolitan State University President Sue Hammersmith, Minnesota West Community and Technical College President Richard Shrub, from Normandale Community College President Joe Opatz. Representing Sue Collins from the Northeast Higher Education District is Provost Mike Johnson and President Rasul Dasman from St. Paul College. I will take all the easy questions. I will call upon them for the hard questions if that meets with your needs. In addition to the presentation, which we're going to keep mercifully brief, we've also provided you, of course, copies of our bonding book. And we've also shared with you a handout which details our project execution plan. And Mr. Yolitz will refer to both of those documents a little later. Our investments are focused on the infrastructure needed to advance Minnesota's workforce, both to improve the learning spaces and support the growing need that Minnesota has for scientists, health professionals, engineers, precision machinists, technologists, and other workers that are in short supply.
Excuse me, Chancellor.
Yes, sir.
One second. We do have a quorum, so I'm going to call the meeting to order. And Representative Drazkowski would move the minutes from last year. Any discussion? See none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are carried. Continue.
Thank you, Chair House. Our proposal, to no surprise, is divided into two parts. The first part are the essential repairs that are listed under HEPR, and those repairs are targeted to protect the workforce training facilities across the system to keep them safe, efficient, dry, warm, and code compliant. The second set of projects are driven by the need for us to try to fill the workforce skills gap that exists here in our state to provide the labs and classrooms needed to deliver to business and industry the graduates with the skills required to meet both current and future workforce needs. Each of the projects we'll be discussing with you today has been through a very rigorous prioritization process, and we are sharing with you only our most urgent needs, roughly one-third of the almost $900 million in projects that are in the pipeline looking forward into the future. As you'll also see, we will describe for you a very efficient and effective execution of projects that you authorized from last year. And those investments have already created the jobs that have put literally thousands of Minnesotans to work in communities across our state. Now, the thing that distinguishes our proposal from all the others you will be considering is not just that we are asking for help so we can put Minnesotans to work, but we are asking for help so we can have the facilities necessary to train workers for the work that needs to be done in Minnesota. That's the focus of our request. Many of you have visited our campuses to gain a much deeper understanding of the projects, and I very much appreciate the time that you have spent to do so. We want to provide both details but also the broader perspective. And there's a way to kind of think of the division of labor here. I want to try to provide a little broader perspective, and Brian will get into some of the greater details on the projects with you today. And, of course, Chair House, I welcome your questions and questions of members at any time that you seem to be appropriate. So I want to start by sharing with you the direction of the system and the priorities and how this particular request helps advance those priorities. Preparing Minnesota's workforce with the job skills required by business and industry is the core mission of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And I can tell you during my first few months on the job how deeply impressed I've been with the very broad and profound impact that our system has on Minnesota's economy, on its citizens, and on businesses across the state. The request before you is on the behalf of 31 colleges and universities across our state. These colleges and universities, as you know, are a vital part of the economic vitality of some 47 communities across our state. Our physical plant is roughly 850 buildings, 27 million square feet across the state. The buildings within the Minsky system represent one-third of all the buildings that are in the portfolio facilities of the state of Minnesota. This is where the teaching and learning and job training happens in our state. Over the past decade, the demand for our programs has soared. Enrollments have increased 15%, and investments in our facilities and our training facilities have to keep pace in order for us to serve the students the way they need to be served, to be prepared for the workforce of today and tomorrow. As I mentioned, we educate over 400,000 Minnesotans every year in communities across our state. We educate 80% of the new nurses, 80% of the people going into the construction trades, 80% of the new cops, 80% of the new mechanics, and the list goes on and on. 9,000 firefighters and first responders every year come out of our colleges and universities. We graduate the civil engineers and the CPAs and the city managers and the entrepreneurs. That is, we educate the people who lead every sector of Minnesota's economy. And 80% of our graduates stay right here in Minnesota and either begin work or go on to further their education. Now, in addition to the programs within our colleges and universities, we also partner with 6,000 businesses across the state to provide customized training to over 122,000 employees each year to ensure that these companies and these employees remain competitive and at the leading edge of their industry. And at the same time, we're very prudent managers of our resources, pushing aggressively to improve productivity and to keep higher education affordable. Over the past 10 years, in constant dollars, the cost of delivering a Minsky education per student we're serving is actually down 10%. The change, of course, is who's covering that cost. And the big shift, as you well know, is that that cost has moved from the state of Minnesota to our students, hence producing the tuition increase. But the actual cost of delivering the education is lower now than it was a decade ago through the efficiencies that we've created in our system. Some of those efficiencies include a 20% boost in the productivity per square foot of the space is measured by the number of student credit hours being produced by that space. Another measure of productivity is the productivity of our faculty, which is up 7% over this time period. And if you look at where the Minsky system stands in the administrative overhead of serving each student compared to the administrative overhead of systems around the country, we rank number 37 out of 50, and that's one of those lists where you want to be near the bottom, not near the top. And the push for constant gains in productivity and efficiencies continues. Our system serves 60% of all the undergraduates in higher education in the state of Minnesota. And the diversity of our programs, as you know from the visits you've had to our campuses, includes highly skilled two-year technical programs, which drive the need for a wide variety of facilities well beyond the typical classroom with the now whiteboards and overhead projectors that might be the stereotype of what college and university education is all about. Let me just give you a couple examples that you see when you visit our campuses. If you look at the health and medical professions, professions like cardiovascular technology, dental hygiene, paramedics, nursing, radiology, and surgical assistants, those programs require learning spaces that include simulation labs, mock dental offices, radiology rooms, even rescue squad vehicles to simulate what work is really going to be like so that these medical professionals are trained for the work they need to do when they go into the health professions. If you think about our manufacturing and robotics programs, those programs require clean spaces, both for the technology that they're supporting, both the electrical and HVAC support necessary, but also clean spaces for the students that are learning in those spaces. Or if you think about our heavy equipment and diesel tractor trailer operation and maintenance programs, you not only need the space to drive and operate that equipment so you learn how to deal with construction loaders and scrapers and bulldozers, those outdoor spaces, but you also need the indoor spaces where you can tear down and rebuild those machines so that you learn how to do that as well. That's what industry needs from us. If you think about our law enforcement programs, you need not just live firing ranges to train peace officers, but you also need the mock-up spaces for the scenario-based response techniques, which are essential to ensuring that those peace officers will be safe and that the people they're serving will be safe. These are the kinds of facilities, along with laboratories and classrooms, that enable our faculty to train the people who will meet Minnesota's workforce needs. And I think, as you know, we serve more than the traditional 19-year-old who's fresh out of high school, though we serve thousands of traditional 19-year-olds fresh out of high school. But we're also the place that adults go to complete certificates, both two-year and four-year degrees, and to take graduate programs, sometimes, oftentimes, while they're holding down full-time jobs. We're also the place that people go when they're displaced from their jobs and it's time to update their skills or simply prepare for a new career.
Chancellor, could you, members, someone's cell phone is too close to the microphone, and I don't know whose it is. I don't think it's mine. Could be. Or it's downloading a very large file. So if you have your cell phone in a purse right below the microphone or out of your pocket right below, stick it in your shirt pocket or hold it under the table. Thanks.
Chair Hoffman, I thought this was only a problem in our classrooms. Apparently not.
Well, unless it's your cell phone.
I just moved mine, sir. How technology helps us along.
Yes.
And finally, as I mentioned, we are the place where businesses, large and small, come to help get the training they need for their employees and to help help solve the problems that they're confronting. We are uniquely positioned to help grow Minnesota's workforce, to help grow Minnesota's economy, and to ensure that we are investing in the facilities necessary to train people to be prepared for the work that needs to be done. One final point on the overview. In addition to growing Minnesota's economy, we are committed to keeping the doors of educational opportunity open for all Minnesotans. We have developed a strategic framework unanimously adopted by our Board of Trustees, which makes three fundamental commitments to the state of Minnesota. First, we are committed to ensuring access to an extraordinary education for all Minnesotans, that is, preparing graduates to lead in every sector of Minnesota's economy. Second, we are committed to being the partner of choice to meet Minnesota's workforce and community needs, and to help ensure that Minnesota has facilities and faculty and talented staff that are in a position to help solve the real-world problems that businesses and industries and communities confront. And finally, we are committed to delivering to students, to families, to taxpayers, and to businesses the most cost-effective, highest-value higher education alternative that's available in Minnesota. And key to every one of these commitments is a strategy, obviously, to meet Minnesota's workforce needs. Now, as I promised at the outset, I want to just give you a very brief overview of how effective we have been in executing the projects that we have brought forward. Every project is aligned with the campus master plan. Every project goes through a very rigorous pre-design process scored by professionals across the system. The board reviews every project, it prioritizes it, it approves and brings them forward as part of our requests. And I participated in the final stages, even as I was becoming chancellor, of the prioritization that is before you today. And I said very clearly that the projects that we bring forward must advance the strategic priorities, which I shared with you. It must minimize the need for additional square footage. They must take care of what we have. They must make it more efficient and more flexible. We must be willing to mothball or demolish those facilities which are no longer viable in terms of conditions, operating costs, or programs. And we should only consider adding additional space if they meet all three of the criteria in the strategic framework, which I just shared with you. My last point before I turn it over to Brian. We have been very efficient and effective in the execution of the investments that you made in 2011, and this last slide is designed to try to summarize that very succinctly for you. The $30 million of HEPR funds have been deployed on 82 projects on all of our campuses. We have Minnesotans working for 229 local contractors and subcontractors. We are on track to have 90% of those project funds encumbered by March 31st of this year. With respect to the $102 million in the seven major capital projects addressing major skills gap needs that exist in our state, all are under contract with 138 firms. Five are already in the ground, and two are in the process of final design for pre-construction services. Put differently, we are 100% on track for the execution of the funds and the execution of the projects that you allocated to us last year. With that kind of global overview of our priorities and the alignment of our project with the workforce needs of Minnesota, let me turn it over to Brian and ask him to walk us through some of the specifics.
And state your name just for the record.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Yolitz. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities for the Minnesota State College and University System. Good afternoon, Chair Howes and committee members. It's good to be with you to outline the requirements for Minnesota State College Universities. In support of our In Capital Improvement Program, Minnesota State College Universities requests $222.5 million in state funding to be combined with $56.2 million from system resources to execute a $278.7 million capital program supporting Minnesota's workforce training and development for 2012. This is the smallest capital request since fiscal year 2000. The capital program is made up of three elements. First is a $110 million request for HEPR, for Higher Education Asset Preservation and Replacement Funds, focused on essential repairs and renewal of existing facility space, directly supporting workforce programs across the system. Second is $157.1 million funding 22 capital projects at 21 of our college and university campuses. 14 of the projects have been before you in the past, totaling approximately $120 million. They were presented in prior capital requests, but ultimately were not funded through the process. And finally, in addition, there's $11.6 million for funding of three system initiatives, where we bundled projects of like theme ranging in the size of $200,000 to $1.5 million to focus on workforce areas at multiple campuses. This request focuses on workforce areas of science, technology, and math, or STEM, energy, and classrooms, and pursues some 21 smaller projects at 14 campuses within the system. All of our projects are shovel-ready, and I draw your attention to the chart that we have with the colored bars on. And we define shovel-ready as being poised and ready to move on to the next phase of design or construction. We recognize that carpenters, electricians, sheet metal workers, painters, and equipment operators really can't go to work until designers, engineers, and architects have done their work. On the colored bar chart, you'll see the projects are listed on the left-hand side in priority order as approved by our Board of Trustees. The color hash marks in the lines to the right show the various phases of design and construction of each of the projects as we would execute those projects. The red and green elements highlight the design phases, specifically A&E selection. Some are through the state designer selection process, followed by the schematic design, design development, and then ultimately construction documents. The yellow and blue elements highlight our bid and award periods, the actual time of construction, and then final punch list and project closeout. The HEPA request for $110 million funds nearly 135 projects generating multiple contracts at 53 of our campuses. It reflects the board's number one capital requirement. Over 95% of this investment is in existing facility infrastructure focused on repairs and in renewal and preservation of both the interior and exterior of our physical plant and addressing aging systems within those facilities, making them more efficient, more effective, and reducing operating expenses for our campuses. The balance addresses code and standard compliance issues and accomplishes advanced design on some of our more complex design projects for future needs. The HEPA portion of the request is critical for our campuses and the maintenance of their plant. It's important to recognize that investments in HEPA is much more than the buildings or the systems and the project titles. It's about the workforce training and learning spaces they serve and protect. HEPA is about protecting and sustaining workforce training capacity for Minnesota. To underscore this point, I'd like to highlight four of the many HEPA requirements we seek to address in this biennium. At St. Cloud Technical and Community College, $1.4 million replaces three 50-year-old boilers with five smaller high-efficiency boilers servicing their main building with nearly 380,000 square feet, and also housing workforce programs in carpentry, auto body, diesel mechanics, electrical, plumbing, HVAC, and metal programs, as well as the transfer programs in the college. It also makes the campus operationally more efficient and drives down operating expenses for the institution. We funded initial design with fiscal year 2011 HEPA dollars, and this work is ready to go to bid in June. In North Mankato at our South Central College, the campus there requires $2 million to replace some 90,000 square feet of roofing over building areas A and E, or E and B, which are leaking and negatively impacting the library, student commons areas, as well as the science, math, English, chemistry, and biology labs and classrooms. At our Brainerd campus of Central Lakes College also has roof issues. $1.9 million would repair leaks above the workforce training areas, including a library, computer labs, fine arts, and STEM classrooms. Both of these projects at Central Lakes and South Central Colleges used fiscal year 11 HEPA dollars to advance design, so that work is ready to go and poised for rapid execution upon funding. And then just up the road from here at Metropolitan State University, $350,000 is needed to replace and update chiller towers at the complex and the supporting piping associated with the system that supports the entire campus area. The chiller system moderates conditions in the workforce training areas for nursing, human services, as well as the liberal arts programs there. It also makes their campus more efficient and more effective in the delivery of service. Each project in our plan has a story just like these. Bottom line, HEPA is about protecting and sustaining workforce training capacity for Minnesota. Our 22 major line item projects focus on supporting workforce needs at the for the communities surrounding our campuses and our state as a whole. The projects touch technical labs, STEM, allied health, as well as general education and baccalaureate needs of the workforce of Minnesota. Many projects touch more than one of these areas. In fact, 9 projects impact all 5. For a brief overview of individual projects, I draw your attention to the bonding book we provided at each year packages. The total request for Minnesota State College Universities is on the first page. It's reflected in priority order along with the financing for each. The next page, page 2, reflects our HEPA requirements and then goes into the individual projects. The first one is at Minneapolis Community Technical College, the workforce program renovation. Also, I believe each of your books is highlighted with the individual workforce areas that's impacted by each project as we go through the book. On page 3, Ridgewater College of Willmar, and as well as the project at Worthington, are projects that you have seen before, and we seek funding for those supporting workforce programs in the area of agriculture, veterinary technology, physical education, allied health, and law enforcement. On pages 4 and 5 reflect projects at Faribault, Coon Rapids, Brooklyn Park, and Marshall, all projects that have been before the legislature seeking funding and past capital requests. On page 6 are 2 new projects, one at St. Paul College, Allied Health and Alliance Center Design, that prepares us for construction of a new addition to that facility, supporting the increased demand for workforce in the areas of allied health at that college. Central College also would be an addition to reflect the growing demand for workforce training at that campus and energy-related and technical programs in science and technology and health careers. On page 7, Rosemont and Rochester projects have been before the legislature in the past and seek funding with this legislative cycle. On page 8 is our first system initiative, the STEM initiative. It supports 10 projects at 9 of our campuses and enables focused emphasis on STEM classrooms and labs at our colleges and universities. The next project is at Mankato at our Metropolitan State University and does design work for a project to be requested in the next legislative cycle. Next project on page number 9 is at Bemidji State. And then Metropolitan State University requests construction funds for a project that was approved in the last legislative cycle for design. And that design should be completed and ready for construction to advance the baccalaureate program here in the metropolitan area, a very important project for the system. On page 10 and 11 are projects at Rochester, our Staples campus for Central Lakes College, Grand Rapids, and Albert Lee. Page 12 and 13. On page 12 is the Energy Initiative with 6 projects at 6 of our campuses focused on energy workforce programs as well as some enhancements to our facilities to operate more efficiently and more effectively. The Classroom Initiative is 5 projects at 4 campuses focused on individual programs and making them more efficient in the delivery of education in those workforce areas. And page 13 is our project at Moorhead, followed by a project at Winona to advance workforce support and programs at those 2 campuses. And finally, on page 14 is at St. Cloud Technical and Community College, the workforce support programs and transportation areas. I believe many of the committee has had an opportunity to see that facility. And finally, at Alexandria Technical and Community College, the main building renovation there to make their operational space more effective there. There's a quick overview of our projects. Stand for any questions that you may have on those. As you'll note, all told, our total capital program directly supports workforce training and development across the state of Minnesota. From the Northeast and the classroom renovation in Ely, at our Vermilion Community College, and the HEPA work at Rainy River Community College in National Falls, to the Transportation Diesel Technology Center renovation, and nurse lab work within the STEM initiative in Moorhead, to the energy and advanced diesel technology programs in Canby, power line training programs in Jackson, and classroom renovations in Faribault. It makes an enormously positive impact on our institutions where workforce learning takes place. In summary, our capital investments are focused on the infrastructure necessary for advancing Minnesota's workforce. Our $278.7 million capital program, again, seeks $222.5 million in state financing with $56.2 million from system resources. It addresses essential repairs and workforce skills gap-driven projects required to deliver the business and industry, the graduates, with the education and skills required to meet their current and future needs. Each project has been vigorously vetted through a rigorous prioritization process, and we are finally committed to a very efficient and effective execution of funds that are provided to us, putting thousands of Minnesotans to work in local communities throughout the state of Minnesota. We're ready to answer any questions that you may have, and we thank you for your time and attention to our capital request.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, my question, I'm looking at the HEPR list, and I see the campuses are in alphabetical order. But my first question is, within a campus request for HEPR, are those listed by priority by that campus?
Chancellor. Representative Carlson, indeed, those are listed in priority order by campus. They've got their most urgent needs are on top, and then the follow-on projects are right behind.
Well, only because they're on the first page, but I'm looking at Bemidji.
Okay.
And down number four is replace roof. And we've had discussions in the past on this committee about roofs and leaky roofs and what that means in terms of future costs. And I don't, again, want to be picking on Bemidji. They just happen to be on the first page. But they've got roofs number four. Replace entrance doors and stairs is number one. Now, without viewing that, I have no idea what that may look like. But I had a discussion with a previous chancellor like this in committee, and they had roofs listed as number 11 or 12. And during the discussion, the chancellor said, well, roofs have just become number one. because that was after I asked a question, were any of those roofs leaking? And the answer was yes. And I said, well, if you've got leaky roofs, why are they not your number one priority? And now HEPR, of course, reflects all kinds of needs. I guess my concern would be, when I look at these lists, I'll ask you the same question. Are any of these roofs leaking?
Chancellor.
With your permission, Chair Howes, I'll yield to Ms. Yolitz, who knows about every single roof in the system. I've yet to master that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, indeed, we've put a big emphasis on roofs in the past. Some 64% of our roofs are up to the Minsky standard, and we're marching our way through our roofs to make the investments where we need to. We've asked each of the colleges to prioritize their needs based on where they are in the life cycle, and the folks at Bemidji have prioritized those based on the urgency of replacement. And they put that the entryway and doorways ahead of the roof. Apparently, they've got enough lifetime left in that roof to get through the execution of the projects ahead of it before they attack the roof there.
Mr. Chairman, that's kind of a bottom line question. Then, are any of the? That's why I say, are any of these roofs leaking? With my good friend and seatmate in this committee and on the House floor next to me, one time we were up at Brainerd Community College, and it happened to be a rainy day on a Saturday, doing a site visit for capital requests, and there were buckets stationed at various parts of the building at the time. And I don't remember if a roof replacement was number one or not, but we were looking at more than just roofs. So my only point is that we have to protect those assets. And I see you have other things like tuck pointing, and if you don't do the tuck pointing, then that increases costs later. I remember when we were over at Falwell Hall one time, there were some major issues and major damages in some of the classrooms due to the separation of some of the exterior wall that was causing some leaking. So I just wanted to make sure that those are appropriate priorities within the categories for those schools, and that at least with roofs. I know when I look at it overall, Mr. Chairman, I see you do put a high priority on roofs. 34% of your HEPA request is roofs, or about $38 million. Apparently there's a risk factor with some of those. They may not be leaking, but they need to be addressed at some point fairly soon, I would assume, if it's on their list.
Chancellor, maybe what you could do is send out an email to all your campuses and ask them to take a look at the roofs and give us an idea of how much longer lifespan they have, which ones are leaking now. So it doesn't have to be specific, I mean, but give us a rough idea what the roofs are at all the campuses.
Chair House, be pleased to do that. Completely agree with the position that Representative Carlos has represented, that fundamentally we need to be protecting the assets, but we also need to be thinking about the health and safety of students and staff that are using these facilities. And in some cases, that leads to air quality to be a higher priority. In some cases, if stairs are crumbling, there's a health and safety risk issue that we need to address right away that might put the roof down a little lower in priority. It's that kind of careful prioritization that the process in place has been very attentive to. So we'll be pleased to respond with an email giving you the specifics on every single roof. But please understand that there's a lot of care that goes into making the hard decision between what's number two and what's number three. And the package that we've provided you are indeed the urgent priorities that we're confronting.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I'll stop with just a comment. During the interim a number of years ago, we had a major study on just the topic of roofs. That's why I kind of perk up on that that issue. We had two fiscal analysts and I think some folks from House Research that worked on that over an entire interim. So when you look at the costs of some of these roofs, I mean, that is a major major issue, both on the funding side but on the protecting of the assets. But thank you.
Chancellor, Representative Carlson brought something to my mind. I visited Itasca Community College, and we were in a lower classroom where the parking lot is about 4 feet higher than the floor in the classroom, and there's grass between, about 5 foot of grass between the parking lot and the building, and the snow gets pushed up and the water goes down. We opened up the cupboard doors, and they pulled some sheetrock back or something, and it's fully covered with mold. And I don't remember who it was, but there was a woman that said they were going to bring in some people to investigate, and I put my hand in there and dragged it on the black mold and showed them. I said, the investigation's done. This is mold. Are you going to fix it? Now, have they fixed that? If you don't know, find out, because that's something that you could have fixed for $250, and those kids wouldn't have to breathe that moldy air. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if the committee prepared the sheet that the summary sheet, higher education bonding, or if that came from the system. But it's, I think it's instructive to the committee to take a look at the history. I, of course, have the particularly painful responsibility for the years 2007 to 2010. And you note there's no bill at all listed in 2007 when, as I recall, the entire bill was vetoed. So this summary of vetoes probably goes even deeper than this. But you see the total amount of higher ed infrastructure fund vetoed during that time was rather overwhelming, and particularly for Minsku. So my question is, we've gone through this book. Do you have any, do you total it all before you did the prioritizing? What came in from all of the campuses? What was that? What was the total request?
Chancellor Yola.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, I believe it was just over $300 million, and we whittled that down based on its alignment with the strategic framework and strategic plan for the system. Also, the demographics of the area is part of our scoring process, getting into more detailed space utilization. Some projects were sent back and said we need some more work on these to make sure that we're indeed making best use of the existing spaces, and maybe you can do some things locally to reconfigure the way you're doing academic programming to deliver those projects. So we tried to make sure that we only asked for the most urgent and pressing needs. Some projects were rearranged in the priority order based on their ability to be executed. So that you see what we need in terms of the highest priorities for the system as approved by our Board of Trustees.
Representative Hauser.
And Mr. Chair, one particular campus that we tried over the years is Canby with a wind turbine, which was in effect their classroom. They have, I think, some of the finest faculty there. One gentleman who's nationally sought, Fred Weiss, and and that's something we've not ever accomplished. And I confess, I also represent the University of Minnesota, but was had some confusion when I discovered that the University of Minnesota has now built a wind turbine on some land it has. So I think of campuses like Canby that have that come with incredible talent in their faculty, and we don't always provide them the classrooms they need for their students. In this case, the classroom is the wind turbine.
If there aren't any more questions, I've got one final question, and then we're going to move on to the DNR. Chancellor, I was sitting in the Jobs Committee last week, and Pine Technical College Incubator was brought up, and I've gotten the answer to my question. You had $600,000 left over from HEPR in 2010, and I questioned the witness as to why was $600,000 since 2010 still sitting there and not putting people to work or fixing a roof or doing something. He couldn't really answer that question now, but Mr. Bernie Ullman did give me a fact sheet on that, and I'll pass it out to members later. I just got it today. But in the future, when you do this, I think you should send a letter to the Chair of Ways and Means and Chair of Capital Investment and also the Senate counterparts. So when you come in with a project and we look at it and see $600,000 carried over from 2010 in HEPR to be used as a capital in a capital project, we don't bounce back in our chair and say, wait a minute, we've been sitting on this money. Now, it's been explained to me. I think what you did was okay, but could you, while you ponder that and let us know ahead of time, would save you some hassle, and also just take another look across your system to make sure there isn't anything else out there that might come before Representative Nornes's committee or somewhere else.
Chair House, be pleased to do so.
Okay. Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen. Just a quick question. I'm new to this committee, but we're looking at 26 different projects for $157 million. Have you considered, and is there any information to tell us what the increased operating cost to the system will be in order to run these new facilities?
Chancellor.
Chair House, Representative, the proposal before you is space neutral, meaning we are proposing taking offline as much space as we are adding. In many cases, we will have much more efficient space than the space we are taking offline. Before any project comes forward, there's a full financial plan for how that space will be operated and paid for. But with a space neutral package, we are not adding more cost to the operation of those facilities. In fact, given the energy efficiency of new facilities and given the HEPR investments we're proposing, we'll actually have much more efficient space from an operations cost point of view.
Representative Dreskos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chancellor. So with each of these projects, then, is there kind of an analysis of what that savings and operational cost would be, and would we be able to come up with a number like that for the project?
Chancellor.
Representative Howes, there is a pro forma that's done on every single project. So each of the energy investment projects, for example, has a pro forma that will identify what savings it is producing. Our goal is to run the physical plant of their universities and colleges as efficiently as we can to free up dollars that will be there for the academic investment and the quality of our programs and in the support of our students.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.
And now for the agency that everyone loves and never disagrees with.
Can you talk about Wilson, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
start.
Mr. Lacusmo, please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, Kent Lacusmo, the Director of Capital Investment for DNR. I may be doing a virtual PowerPoint here for you, but we'll see if that gets sorted out. You have three things in your packet, I believe. One is a copy of the actual PowerPoint presentation, a copy of our fact sheet, and then what we provided as a budget tracker. Which shows capital budget appropriations from 2000 through last year, 2011. Let's see if we get this going. The department has changed how we're approaching the capital budget presentations. And as you know, we don't have each division represented here. I don't pretend to know all the specifics about all these programs, but we'll certainly be able to provide answers if the committee has specific questions. We're the department's mission. I'm sure everybody has seen the three circles.
Isn't even.
Here we go. That show the outdoor recreation, economic development, natural resources protection, and what we're trying to do is strive to balance between those three goals. The department's mission is that we'll work with the citizens to conserve and manage the state's natural resources, provide outdoor recreation opportunities, and to provide for commercial uses of natural resources in a way that creates a sustainable quality of life. So the goals of this administration are to do that through providing that Minnesota's waters, lands, fish and wildlife habitats will be conserved and enhanced, that the outdoor recreation system will be diverse and of high quality to meet the needs, management of our natural resources to contribute to strong job markets, economies, and communities, and also to have operational excellence and to focus on continuous improvement. In the 2012 capital budget, we're looking at three main areas: maintaining a strong conservation infrastructure. DNR is one of the largest state agencies. We have more work locations, more varied work sites, and capital assets worth more than $1 billion. We also look at creating jobs and supporting local economies. We're targeting investments that contribute to strong job markets, economies, and the communities. And then also, we and some of the programs will leverage other resources, and we try to do that to the maximum extent possible. In the state's natural resource-based economies, which includes recreation, tourism, forestry, water and mineral resources, just for example, the forest products industry is the fourth largest manufacturing sector with a total annual economic impact of $18 billion. We're the nation's highest per capita participation in fishing, and for hunters, park visitors, trail users, wildlife watchers, we're above the national average. And wildlife and wildlife watching generates $4.3 billion. The statewide trail activities are estimated to generate $3.3 billion. You add all those up, it's about a $30 billion impact from those specific areas. What we did for our capital budget process this year, the agency, the operating divisions identified their needs. That created a list of about $360 million. That then we refined meetings with the commissioner and division directors. We developed a prioritized program and submitted that request to MMB in the governor's office. And that list was $160 million in 22 different program areas. And then the governor's office considered that and made their recommendation of $55.5 million. And that's what I'm going to present today as the governor's budget of $55.5 million. We did prioritize the projects 1 through 22, and that was with an expectation that you don't fund all of priority 1 before you move to priority 2. It's a pretty diverse agency, and it would be difficult to approach it in that manner. Looking at maintaining a strong infrastructure, DNR has more than 5 million acres of state lands. We maintain buildings and recreational facilities, public accesses through trails and the public boat accesses. Take care of Minnesota's assets to ensure the health and safety of the Minnesotans. We improve delivery of our conservation services, improve recreational opportunities. We like to reduce operating costs and increase efficiencies. And so all of these requests include programs like asset preservation, roads and bridges, and parks and trails development. We have more than 200 work locations statewide, and there's recreational facilities in every county of the state. We own and actively maintain over 2,700 buildings, and that's buildings ranging from an outhouse to a large regional office. But if you add them all up, there's over 2,700. The capital investments that we do put people to work in communities across the state. And we are able to spend spend money quickly. In calendar year 11, we expended in bond funds more than $107 million. And if you looked at fiscal years for 10 and 11, it was about $90 million each for those fiscal years. The flood hazard mitigation program in 2010, appropriation, we spent 98.6% of that money already. 2011, there's 87% of that money spent. Asset preservation in 2011, you know, we benefited from an appropriation of $17 million, and that there's about $14 million of that that's under requisition status. There's projects being done. We have done 43 roof projects. And that's without looking at the counting the roofs that are in the St. Croix State Park, where the blowdown was, and virtually every roof in that park was damaged and is being repaired. The capital budget request includes, in the $55.5 million, is flood hazard mitigation, $20 million, dam repair and reconstruction, $7 million, asset preservation, $3 million, the water access renewal, aquatic invasive species control, $12 million. Groundwater monitoring, $500,000. RIM critical habitat map match is $3 million. Roads and bridges, $5 million. And parks and trails renewal and development is $5 million. Now, the fact sheet lists some specific program priorities that that you have. And I'll go through each of those real briefly here. Starting with flood hazard mitigation, the you've seen this numerous times over the last 2 years. And this program provides grants to local units of government to design and implement long-term measures to reduce flood damage. And since 1988, we've removed 2,500 homes and businesses from the floodplain. And I think since 2009, it's probably over 170 in Moorhead specifically. It's somewhere around that number. I didn't get an exact. But they have it's much easier and a better approach to remove the hazard from the floodplain instead of trying to spend money to protect it, and we certainly have encouraged that. And we've had major floods the last in the last decade that point out the importance of this program. It is cost effective. The FEMA studies indicate that for every $1 spent on prevention, you save $4 in future damages prevented. And I know there's lots of questions about when this program will end, but we are getting projects completed with the funding in the last 3 years. We've completed 19 projects totally done, and we have completed many specific phases in a lot of other communities. And I think if you talk to the communities there, they will definitely tell you that they're benefited by the investment in flood hazard mitigation, that their flood fights are much easier than they were in the past. So we have reduced the flood risk in communities significantly by the purchase and removal of properties, the relocation of businesses, and construction of levees, flood walls, and those types of projects. We looked at this, how we prioritize is looking at where are the most risks. And the historically, the four cities in Minnesota that had the highest repetitive losses from flooding were East Grand Forks, Warren, Breckenridge, and Roseau. And East Grand Forks and Warren have projects that are completed. Breckenridge is nearly done with their project, and Roseau is maybe 75% done. There's still funding to be done there. Those were all federal projects, and they were held up perhaps a little bit by the lack of federal funding or the delay in federal funding. But those are for repetitive loss communities that we aren't going to hear from anymore once these projects are completed. The city of Moorhead has gotten a fair amount of money the last few years, but their funding for a same level flood as they got in 2009 would be about 80% less than they spent then. They will save potentially $8 million in sandbags in preparation based on the work that we've done and that we are doing. Dam repair, reconstruction, removal. This request was $7 million. There are 800 public dams in the state. 430 of them are state-owned. The state-owned dams, we obviously pay the full cost. On the public dams, there's a 50-50 cost share with the local governments. And we estimate this is a long or infrastructure issue, that these are many old dams, many more than 50 years old, that will need repairs going forward. The certainly we look first at high hazard dams, and one of the requests this year is for Billsby, which is county owned, and they have their cost share, and it's a high hazard dam that we're proposing to upgrade by increasing this capacity of the emergency spillway. So this request beyond that project and making sure previously funded projects can be totally finished. We aren't sure on the total cost on Shady Lake down in Orinoco, which had an appropriation. Coon Rapids, we're in the process of doing the engineering. We think we have sufficient funds, but it could be a little bit over. So we certainly fund those. And this request would also fund 15 projects from our dam safety priority list. And we are required in the odd numbered year to provide the committees a list of the dam safety priority list. And
excuse me, Mr. Loxmo, Representative Scalzi has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Loxmo, I'm curious. I see that we have 800 public dams, 430 state-owned. And I haven't been on the Environment Committee for a while, but there's a limit to how many you can repair or remove every year. That's one question. But the other question I have is about what percentage of these dams have been of human creation to make a lake that was not there previously?
Mr. Loxman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, I would say most of the dams were there to create a lake. Some obviously were created for hydropower, and there is a small impoundment behind them. But many of the of the dams are there to create a lake. And if you look at Lake Minnetonka, the dam isn't real high, but it makes a big difference on the usability of Lake Minnetonka. Take a foot or two of water off of Lake Minnetonka, or off Leech Lake, or off any of these reservoirs that are controlled by dams, it would affect the navigability and probably be a boon to propeller repair business. And your first question was, how many can we do? In the many of these projects are our smaller projects once we get past the Dillsby Dam project, which is in total about a $4.5 million project, half by the state and half by local government. The others are more in the neighborhood of $250,000 to $300,000 projects. So within the biennium, we could do the work on these 15.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you can work on 50 per year. That's what I heard. And out of these 800 dams, how many need repair, of which we're only repairing 50 per year?
Mr. Loxton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi. What we're proposing is 15, not 50. And what we've done is we create a dam safety priority list that has about, probably less than 100 dams on there. Those are the ones that are in the worst condition, and we work down that list as money allows.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just as a follow-up for these dams that you say most of them have been constructed by humans to create a lake where there was not one before, do those property owners then that have achieved lakeshore property, do they share in the repair of the dam that creates their lakeshore enhancement?
Mr. Locksmith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, only through the local property taxes or state taxes that they would pay. There's not a specific charge. Unless the local government, if it's a local government-owned dam, they may approach that differently, but I'm not aware of any that have. I believe it's through the taxing authorities of the state and local government.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of following up on that, I wanted to clarify the Lake Billsby Dam that would be funded out of the $7 million that is in your priority list.
Mr. Locksmith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, yes.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the Lake Billsby Dam, I believe you said, had a significant local match of 50%. I want to go back to something we did last summer with the Coon Rapids Dam, and I'd like to know what the local match was on the Coon Rapids Dam.
Mr. Luxma.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, there was no local match for the Coon Rapids Dam.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lacusmo, on the Coon Rapids Dam, we were sold that dam as a cart barrier. And at $16 million. And I know, talking to folks who are somewhat in the construction trades and that bids come in lower. And I thought I heard you say earlier that the cost might be higher than $16 million. Is that correct?
Mr. Luxman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, until we have a design and the type of gates picked out and an actual bid, we don't know if it'll be higher or lower.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lacusmo, so that we don't have a completed design for this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, that's correct. We have just selected an engineer, and they're commencing on the design.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, so we've appropriated $16 million without having a true cost, without a design. I think, Mr. Lacusmo, there was some discussion about building a coffer dam in addition to hold the water so that the residents could enjoy their recreation while the dam was being built. Is that part of the cost?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, it will be necessary to build a coffer dam to do the construction. The point of discussion was whether or not the coffer dam would be constructed to hold the water level, or to hold the water at what level during construction. Because the higher you hold the water level during construction, the more expensive the coffer dam.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Lacusmo, is the coffer dam bondable if it's only going to be there temporarily?
Mr. Lacusmo. And Representative Hansen, yes, it's the cost of construction.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Lacusmo, even if it's not going to stay there for 20 years?
Mr. Lacusmo.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, yes.
Representative Hansen.
We have a council check on that if we're building a temporary structure. respondability. It doesn't have to be.
Representative Hanson, we'll check on that. And as long as we're talking about the dam, I thought it was $17 million. Correct me if I'm wrong. And we did give you the ability to design build, and I'm a little disappointed you didn't take that because I have a sense you'd already be working on it had you gone there. So I'm not going to lecture you any more than that. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of the 800 dams, how many does the DNR believe ought to be removed?
Mr. Locksmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, we have removed about 20 over the last decade. And lately, instead of actual removal, what's done is you put a rock slope in front of the dam, so it removes the drowning machine threat, and it provides for fish passage. So I would say there's probably, it's really a very rough guess, another 20 maybe that would be removed.
Representative Hausman?
I don't know if that's a... Are there two ways to answer that? How many of the 800 does the DNR believe should be removed?
Mr. Locksmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, we can look at that and see if we can provide a better number for the committee without me discussing Alaska or fisheries folks, because I know they're looking at it. We've removed or modified most of the dams on the Red River. The one remaining to be removed is at Drayton, North Dakota, and there's proposals to work on that to remove that one. And we will we'll get a better number for the committee.
Continue.
I should point out in this picture, the top dam here is the Dillsby Dam, and that's county owned. And the picture on the bottom is the Coon Rapids Dam. Natural resources asset preservation. And I believe the committee knows that in DNR there's a broader definition of asset preservation. It extends to all DNR facilities, including the recreational facilities. So our capital budget expenditures for asset preservation are the following types of projects: code compliance, ADA requirements, the hazardous material abatement, access improvement, building energy efficiency, and building repairs for both the interior and exterior. And then renewal of infrastructure for utility systems, site improvements. And our focus of late has been just on buildings within the department, because we've been really underfunded in this area for many years. So the $17 million that we got last year is going predominantly towards buildings. And this picture is a picture at St. Croix State Park. We've got a backlog of more than $500 million for all types of asset preservation needs, and that's for the types of projects that I just mentioned, the ADA improvements, roof, doors, windows, mechanical, electrical systems. This puts local people to work doing these projects all across the state. The water access renewal and aquatic invasive species. This request is $12 million. It's to design and construct a deterrent barrier for Asian carp, and we are having discussions with the Corps of Engineers, because the discussions lately are, should this be done at Lock and Dam 1 at Hastings, St. Anthony Falls, and what are the requirements from the Corps to do the work on their locks and dams. So that's moving forward, but there are some hoops to jump through with the federal government, obviously.
Mr. Locksmo, I would have a question on that. On your other sheet here, it says $12 million. For three items?
Yes.
One of them is design construction of a deterrent barrier for Asian carp. The next one is design and redevelopment of public water accesses to improve aquatic invasive species management, shoreland management, and ADA components. And then AIS decontamination stations at public water accesses. How much are number two and three going to cost, and what does that leave you left for building a barrier?
Mr. Chairman, we haven't split out the cost for these three items precisely, because we're trying to determine a better cost for what a deterrent barrier may cost. There's been lots of discussion about whether or not it can be an electric barrier, a bubble barrier. There are safety concerns by the Corps of Engineers on the electric barriers. So instead of at this juncture guessing at what dollar numbers we should put on each of these, we have left it open. And the design and redevelopment of public water accesses, as you look at that, I mean, that's it can be a few hundred thousand dollars a piece for a number of those, and the same for the decontamination stations. These are developing accesses and modifying them, so it is easier to do the decontamination and the treatment for aquatic invasives.
The decontamination station, would that be a permanent facility or a mobile facility?
The work that we're talking about in this bonding request is to construct the permanent modifications to a site so you could accommodate a mobile facility, and we're also looking at what it would take to build a permanent facility.
Well, my suggestion would be if you're going north of Highway 210, especially north of Highway 2, not to put in a permanent station, because a lot of folks up north with a muddy pickup will just pull up and wash off their pickup truck and put all that in the lake. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question also is about the decontam units. And how many units are you looking at, or what is the amount of dollar figures for decontam units?
Mr. Lux.
Appropriated.
Well, initially, we had a request for $7 million for the public water accesses and the decontamination stations. We had a rough idea of $5 million for the barrier for Asian Park. But because those numbers are so soft, we don't have a precise number for each. And we're trying to define those numbers and get a better number. But at this point, the individual public accesses, like I said, there are probably a couple hundred thousand of these.
Period.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and I'm glad to hear that, you know, they're mobile units, portable units, rather than permanent units. Where's the permanent site being considered?
Mr. Luxman.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ward, we would be looking at putting those sites at lakes with heavy use and with existing contamination. For example, lakes infested by zebra mussels, so Lake Minnetonka, for example. Mississippi River at Hastings, Gull Lake, Mille Lacs Lake, Lake Ossawinamakee. You know, those are the examples.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm glad to hear a couple lakes that are in my area that are significantly increasing in the spread of zebra mussel, Mille Lacs and Gull, and Ossawinamakee is fully loaded. So I'm glad to hear that. And so the criteria, if I heard you correctly, the criteria will be to look at all lakes around the state of Minnesota, especially those that are infested and heavy infestation and heavy usage, will be a top priority then.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ward, that is correct.
Thank you.
The next area was groundwater monitoring. For $500,000, and this is for $500,000, and this is to do groundwater monitoring, install observation wells, several deep wells, and 20 shallow wells, and then identify and seal unused wells. And this is for work in outstate Minnesota. There has been clean water funding provided before that has been geared towards the metropolitan counties. So these dollars would go outstate. 75% of the state's population depends on groundwater, so this is important to monitor that resource and be able to address emerging needs. The RIM critical habitat match, the request here is $3 million. And the critical habitat match provides...
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question about the groundwater monitoring. Can you just review for us what you're looking for in the groundwater monitoring?
Mr. Lux.
Is Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark. Our groundwater monitoring is looking predominantly at quantity and levels to see if there's changes based on increased use and stresses on the resource. And we're looking at specific areas in the state where there are known problems. There's these wells aren't constructed for water quality sampling. We combine those two functions as much as possible. But these are for water quantity measuring throughout the state.
So it's quantity, it has nothing to do with contamination by any means?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, it would have very little to do. If there were known contaminants, we could potentially take some samples, but these aren't built for a sampling well. They're usually 2-inch wells that are used just to determine the levels of the groundwater.
Just one final question. Well, I guess two things actually. So, which part of our state government is looking at the contaminants in those? Is it the health department? And do you work with them at all on anything?
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, we work with the health department, MTCA, on designing and defining the entire system, and we share data with the other agencies.
Okay, and then just one last thing. So in terms of the quantity and levels then, I'm aware of various proposals that are happening around that would, take millions of gallons of water from our aquifers a day for energy needs. It definitely affects the quantity and levels of water. Is that something that you're coordinating with the other agencies that might be looking at that, or is that just, are you all in your own silos?
Mr. Luxman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark. No, we coordinate that with the other agencies, and there's work groups that look at the monitoring needs and at the data that is gathered by both our water use reporting on an annual basis from all the permits that exist for water users in Minnesota, and then also on the and our information is posted on the web. It's easily obtainable, and the other agencies use that in their decision making and their developments of their programs.
Thank you.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to piggyback off of Representative Clark's question, and I'm going to be more specific. Will you be working with, or are you going to be collaborating with Bowser Soil and Water Conservation Districts on this project, since it's now, I heard you say it's now a Greater Minnesota focus, as I thought, what I thought I heard you say, and those agencies are doing, a remarkable job in helping with groundwater monitoring as well. So will you be working with those agencies specifically?
Mr. Loxmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ward, yes, we do it. And actually, the existing groundwater monitoring system that we have 650 wells in the system now is most of those are read by the Soil and Water Conservation District technicians, and we have agreements with them to conduct those readings. So there's so they are paid for that service of providing those readings.
Thank you.
The RIM Critical Habitat Match, it's a program that leverages state investments to private donations. And you have the license plates that generate $3.5 million a year. And this request of $3 million supplements that, because we have more donations of mostly land but some cash that are used then to acquire critical property throughout the state.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's sometimes confusion on the part of some when they see RIM. Can you help us understand the difference between your line that says RIM and a Bowser line that says RIM?
Mr. Luxman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman. This RIM program is for the Critical Habitat Match Program, which is funded in part by the habitat license plates, which those donations that are made on those license plates are treated as state money, and then that money is used one-to-one to cover the donations of land and or property. So that and follows our RIM program is more the acquisition of easements and property. I guess I'll have to, I can probably talk to Bowser and get something more specific for you.
Representative Hausman?
I just wanted to sort of raise it for the record. Occasionally there is some confusion when people see it. They think this is the one that has the federal match. This doesn't match the...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, this does not match federal dollars. This money and this bonding request is used to match private donations of land. And some cash, but most of the donations that the department receives are donations of land. That land has gone up in value significantly across the state, so there's some pretty large donations that we receive that are in the office.
Excuse, what did you say?
That the value of land
has gone up? And why are my people in Crow Wing County having difficulty with the Nature Conservancy and the DNR in getting that land transferred to you, and they are fighting because the appraisals are coming in $120,000, $130,000 low?
Mr. Chairman, my comment was based on a longer history than the last couple of years.
Oh. Great spin. You should run for office. Okay, continue.
Mr. Chairman, the next area is roads and bridges, $5 million. And if you'll recall that last year we combined our roads and bridges request into one, so you don't have a separate request from forestry and from parks and from wildlife. So we have in DNR over 3,000 miles of roads and bridges, and that provide access to 5 million acres of state land. There's the existing road and bridge system is worth more than $100 million. You see on these pictures, the top picture is the before and the bottom picture is the after for a bridge in the Fedora State Forest that was replaced in 2009. So that was a local contract, a local company, and you know, I think it was a couple week job. So this request will continue the repair and replacement of those roads and bridges throughout the system.
Oh, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lockesville, on the picture that you just talked about, on the top picture obviously is a 50-year-old bridge. I'm curious, the bottom picture, is that considered a bridge or a culvert?
Mr. Lockesville.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, I would call the bottom picture.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And following up on that, Mr. Lockesmore, are you finding you have to be enlarging your culverts or expanding your bridge system to handle greater volumes of water within your system? I mean,
Mr.
Lockesmore.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I'm not sure of the answer to that question, whether or not they've done that analysis. But typically, when you go from a bridge to a culvert, you're reducing size. I mean, often for fisheries resources, you want larger culverts to control the velocity of the water through the opening. So there is a balance on that, depending on the type of system that you're dealing with, the river that you're dealing with. I can ask that question and see if we can get a more precise answer for you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's good because at some point your culvert issue intersects with your flooding issue and then your cost issue and your repair issue. So you could kind of get some data.
Mr. Lockesmore, while you're on the subject of culverts, up in Akeley, there's a county road. I think it's the 11th Crow Wing Lake. We talked about it a couple years ago about putting in a new culvert because you have in there a metal one now and it's kind of sinking a little bit. I believe it's 10 feet high and then it's full of silt, so you can't get a boat underneath the road through that culvert, let alone a pontoon. And it's supposed to be one lake, not the 11th and 12th Crow Wing. Could you check on that and see what kind of progress there might be on that? I think you were also working with MnDOT on the same thing.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's not a DNR-owned road, I don't believe. But I will check on the history. I know we talked about it a couple years ago.
No, you don't own the road, no, but you own and are responsible for the culvert that goes under the road. Or we could just fill it up if you weren't.
Mr. Chairman, we will. I will check on the
Thank
status
you very
of
much.
That. I know we did some investigation earlier. The last area that we have here is the Parks and Trails Renewal and Development, and this request is $5 million. And this request was going to go mostly towards the renewal and replacement of the infrastructure in the state parks and trails. The as you see on the slide, there's 109 miles of state trails, dozens of bridges, and most campgrounds are in need of renewal. And obviously, this request won't do that. They'll prioritize a list and be the ones that are most urgent.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Lockesmo, have you started that prioritized list, or?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ward, yes, Parks and Trails has developed a very preliminary list. I mean, all of these lists have a way of adjusting over time as things change. But they were looking for that $5 million at the Itasca State, the bike trail in Itasca Park, trail renewal on Cicada, Root River, Willard Munger, and some facility rehab in parks at Minneopa, McCarthy Beach, Sibley, and Itasca State Park Boardwalk Rehab, group camp enhancement at Afton State Park, and a few camper cabin development at Scenic and Frontenac State Park.
Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry, Representative Ward.
Thank you. So, Mr. Lockesmo, I heard a lot of, is that a statewide kind of list?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ward, yes.
Do you know what the, excuse me, Mr. Chair?
Representative Ward.
Thank you. Mr. Locksmo, do you know the kind of breakdown from, you know, the greater Minnesota area to the metro area?
Mr. Locksmo.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ward, the within the metropolitan counties, I believe the only project would be at the Afton State Park.
Representative Ward.
You know, thank you, Mr. Chair. And can you provide me and, I don't know, other members, if they want other members, can you provide me with a list, please?
Mr. Chairman, certainly.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lockesmo, I'd like to go back to the flood mitigation work. I'm sure that's not a surprise to you that I would ask about that. First of all, I want to thank you for the excellent work that you continue to do in trying to shepherd flood mitigation work throughout the state. What I think sets flood mitigation investments apart from other investments that we make here is that for every dollar that we invest, we save how many, Mr. Lockesmo?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning, the FEMA estimate was $4.
So if we invest $20 million, as this budget proposal has, that you potentially have $80 million in savings. And I think as we look at flood mitigation requests, we need to keep that in mind. And also, you've noted in your printout here that over and above the $20 million that's in this budget, there's over $100 million in other requests or needs that are out there in flood mitigation. So obviously, I know it comes as no surprise to you that I would feel that the $20 million is very light in terms of trying to make investments that will actually save all of us, state and local governments, federal government, considerable amounts of money. How would we go about with the $20 million budget in trying to possibly parcel that funding out to meet the requests that are out there?
Well, Mr. Lux.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lanning, what we've done in the past with the fund, and obviously the more money there is, the easier it is to juggle that those requests, but we have many competing requests. We look at the amount of risk that is presented by the communities and who is really ready to spend the money. Often community requests, they are not as ready or able to spend the money as quick as they would indicate. But there are some communities that have shown the ability to spend money quickly and that are still at significant risk, and we would focus the money towards them. We ask communities to provide projects in discrete phases so we can fund a given phase that will have specific benefit for that community. And so we approach funding that way to look at projects and phases. And that I know, the city of Moorhead has identified a need of $20 million, for example. They could take this entire request. But there are a lot of other competing needs. And we have competing needs in all of our programs. There's a lot of trail requests and a lot of other things, but we're going to have to balance and set priorities as we can.
Well, we certainly, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We certainly understand that you have to meet the needs of communities throughout the state. Overall, this $55.5 million budget I would consider pretty modest given the needs that there are. And one of the questions that raises with me is what process does DNR go through in determining what comes forward in the form of a bonding request versus request of other sources of funding, like Legacy, Environmental Trust Fund, and the like. Are there things that are on this list that should really be candidates for funding through other sources as opposed to through the bonding request?
Mr. Luxman.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lanning, there is funding that Parks and Trails receives, for example, for Parks and Trails projects. But we didn't look at the other sources of funding and preclude, Parks and Trails from asking for bonding money. Bonding has been a historical funding area for those types of projects, and we continued that request. So there are areas within, the other heritage accounts for Lessard Sands. I mean, there's lots of acquisition. Acquisition is not funded in this, in the governor's proposed budget here, but there are avenues for them to have acquisition through other sources of funds. But in our request, we didn't weigh what the potential was for other funds. We looked at what a balanced approach was for a bonding request to put forward.
Mr. Chairman, just one
final question. Keep it as quick as you can. We've still got five more people that want to speak. We've got 9 minutes left.
Well, it would seem to me that we need to consider all the different sources of funds as we make budget decisions on capital investment. And I know we're not the committee that decides those other funding streams, but it seems to me somebody ought to be doing that. And if there are things on this list that really are candidates for funding in one of those other revenue sources, I would hope that we're taking a look at that. Thank you.
Representative Drazkowski, and be as brief as you can, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, my questions were really dovetail into what Representative Lanning was talking about. And Mr. Lockesmo, I'd be curious, as I look at these, I'm curious as to whether some of these flood hazard mitigation dollars are some of the types of dollars we talked about in this committee last year up in Representative Fabian's area. Some things that were portions of these flood hazard mitigation projects that were environmental enhancements in nature. And we talked about the ability potentially for us to go to the Outdoor Heritage Fund or the Clean Water Fund for those. And if, as I recall, your agency has asked those particular groups that are making those recommendations as they come forward for that, and were denied. That's what I thought I remembered. I'm curious as to whether this particular $20 million request includes some of those environmental enhancements that might fit into those categories. And then I have just a quick line of questioning.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, The environmental enhancements that you mentioned are part of projects in the Red River Valley that come through the mediation process that you know happened a decade or so ago. There is you know at the $20 million number there. Well, there are some impoundment projects that are continuing to be funded through this request, and those impoundment projects in the Red River Valley have natural resource enhancements. The department, I think the project sponsors, the watershed districts, were the one that requested money from Lasard Sams, not the agency, but those requests were not funded.
Representative Dreskos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lacusmo, so I'm curious of what the department's perspective is around the whether or not these would be potentially proper fits for use or for funding from the Clean Water Fund or from the Outdoor Heritage Fund, those enhancements we talked about, would those be would they be proper fits for the use of those dollars as we look at the Constitution, as we look at the water access renewal, aquatic invasive species, the carp barrier, the boat ramps and other aquatic invasive species enhancements, and the truck and boat car wash program, and the groundwater monitoring, would that be proper to come from the Clean Water Fund? The RIM critical habitat match, would that be proper for that to come from the Outdoor Heritage Fund? The Parks and Trails Renewal and Development, $5 million, would that be proper for that to come from the Parks and Trails Fund from the legacy dollars? I'm curious as to whether each of those would be proper fits if indeed this legislature, in coordination with the bodies that make the recommendations to the legislature, would come to the conclusion as well that those were proper. In the agency's estimation, would that be a proper fit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gruskowski, I think generally, yes, and it would be a proper fit, and many of those things have had funding through those various other funds. I mean, Clean Water Fund has funded that groundwater monitoring in the metro area, and so it could be expanded, and I think there are, the other areas have received funding. Parks and Trails obviously has received funding from their legacy dollars, and the other areas have received some funding, so.
Thank you.
Representative Rucavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, I know you're stressed out here for time, so maybe we can bring them back, the DNR, because, you know, I've got some concerns. I agree with Representative Lanning that a lot of this $55.5 million is very justified. But in the past, and both of them bring up, Representative Dreskowski and Representative Lanning bring up good points, how much is being run through, you know, LCCMR and the whole legacy funding? Because I sit on the LCCMR, I have on and off for many years, and, you know, the DNR is always there getting land, buying new land. And, you know, this whole issue, members of school trusts that I've been on for 26 years, I know I'm a broken record, but I finally got people to start understanding it on both sides of the aisle. And as an example, you know, what sticks out in my craw here, the Vermilion Lake State Park. And fine, you know, we purchased, I think, 7,000 feet of shoreline, Mr. Loxmo, but, and I hate to pound on you because this isn't, you know, this is above your pay scale. I wish Myers were here to pound on. But anyway, you know, there's 22 miles of shoreline, I believe, of school trust land that the DNR insisted be traded on Lake Vermilion. And it's never generated a penny for the school trust. And I think before you go buy new land through the LCCMR, the DNR, or through the legacy funding, you should buy that land for the people of the state and pay the school kids instead of constantly abusing them like it's been done for 30 years. There's no trustee I know in the United States of America that would give U.S. Steel $18 million instead of the school kids of this state, and they could have traded even up. But when you don't have any, you know, anybody watching you, you don't care. So I'm curious to see what kind of land purchases in the last decade have been run through other sources, be it the legacy funding or the LCCMR, and I'd like to see that in a sheet besides all of your other purchases here for
acquisitions of various different types, rather than kind of carrying out the fiduciary responsibility of the school children in the state. And you don't have to answer. I don't want to pick on you, Ken. But, you know, I wish Myers were here. He ran.
Well, I'm not going to let you answer. I'm going to go to Representative Kahn and then Representative Hausman, and then we're going to adjourn.
I just have a general comment on some of these, and I don't know where we need staff work from the legislature or from the agencies themselves. As I look at these things, one of the things that I'm most supportive of funding for is any kind of HEPR which ends up really can be analyzed on a cost avoidance, that doing it now is going to save us a pile of money from what we're going to have to do. And, you know, they can be graphed many ways, the amount of money we'll save, the time in which we'll save the money, and so forth. And I know it all kind of gets lumped together, but I just wondered if there's some way of making an analysis as to which HEPR, of all of the HEPR projects that we have, you know, which ones are going to be the most effective along that line of cost avoidance. So I don't expect you to answer it.
I'm not going to answer it now, but I will ask the agencies to bring that forward and have staff look into that. Representative Hausman?
And mine are just two comments as well, Mr. Chair. One, I think our discussion today has probably set the stage for some constitutional court challenges on the supplement issue, which is quite clear for legacy dollars at Clean Water and Outdoor Heritage. So I think somebody should save this tape. But the other is, I think this budget tracker has been a very helpful piece. And as we were talking about flood hazard mitigation, I just did some quick math to realize how generous we've become on this line. Because from 2000 to 2007, 7 years, we did 100,000. In the last 4 years, we did 200,000. So we have suddenly, over the last 4 years, become significantly more either aggressive or generous. I don't know which is the word I should use in terms of that line.
Well, Mr. Luckenfeld, we thank you, and I think we will be bringing the DNR back in the future. We've got plenty of time to put the bonding bill together. We won't be out of here until at least May 5th. So with that, we're adjourned.